The nose of the Mercedes was 50 feet from the Land Rover's tail, and gaining. 100 yards from the solid barrier across the road was a low place in the right-hand bank. Tungata swerved into it, and the ugly, blunt-nosed vehicle flew up it, all four wheels clawing as it went over the top, and tore like a combine harvester into the high yellow stand of elephant grass beyond. Craig knew he could not follow him. The low-slung Mercedes would tear her guts out on the bank. He raced past it, and then hit the brakes as the roadblock loomed up and filled his windshield. The Mercedes broadsided to a dead stop in a storm of its own dust, and Craig threw his weight on the door and tumbled out into the road. He caught his balance and scrambled up the right-hand bank. The Land Rover was 20 yards away, engine roaring in low gear, crashing and bouncing over the broken ground, mowing down the dense yellow grass whose stems were thick as a man's little finger and taller than his head, weaving between the forest trees, its speed reduced by the terrain to that of a running man. Craig saw that Tungata would succeed in detouring around the roadblock, and he ran to head off the Land Rover. Anger and fear for Sally Ann seemed to guide his feet. He stumbled only once on the rough footing. Tungata Zabiwa saw him coming, and lifted the rifle one-handed, aiming over the bonnet of the jolting, roaring Land Rover. But Sally Ann threw herself across the weapon, clinging to it with both arms, her weight forcing the barrel down, and Tungata could not take his other hand from the wheel as it kicked and whipped in his grip. They were past the roadblock now, and Craig was losing ground to them, realizing with a slide in his chest that he could not catch them. He floundered along behind the roaring vehicle. Sally Ann and Tungata were struggling confusedly together, until the big black man tore his arm free and, using the hand as a blade, chopped her brutally under the ear. She slumped face forward onto the dashboard, and Tungata swung the wheel over. The vehicle swerved, giving Craig a few precious yards advantage, and then it seemed to hover for an instant on the high bank beyond the roadblock before it leapt over the edge and dropped into the roadway with a clangor of metal and spinning tires. Craig used the last of his reserves of strength and determination and raced forward to reach the place on the bank an instant after it had disappeared. 10 feet below him, the Land Rover was miraculously still the right way up, and Tungata, badly shaken, his mouth bleeding from impact with the steering wheel, was struggling for control. Craig did not hesitate. He launched himself out over the bank, and the drop sucked his breath away. The Land Rover was accelerating away, and he dropped half over the tailgate. He felt his ribs crunch on metal, his breath whistled in his throat as it was driven from his lungs, and his vision starred for an instant. But he found a grip on the radio set and hung on blindly. He felt the Land Rover surging forward under him, and hearing Sally Ann whimpering with pain and terror. The sound steeled him, his vision cleared. He was hanging over the back of the tailgate, his feet dangling and dragging. Behind him, the army truck was swinging out of the roadblock, engine thundering and headlights glaring in pursuit, while just ahead, the main road T-junction was coming up with a rush as the Land Rover built up to her top speed again. Craig braced himself for the turn. But even so, when it came, his upper arms were almost torn from their shoulder sockets as Tungata took the left fork on two wheels. Now he was heading north. Of course, the Zambian border was only 100 miles ahead. The road went down into the Great Escarpment, and there was no human settlement in that tsetse fly-infested, heat-baked wilderness before the border post and the bridge over the Zambezi at Chirundi. With a hostage, it was just possible he could reach it. If Craig gave up, he could reach it, or get himself and Sally Ann killed in the attempt. By inches, Craig dragged himself back into the Land Rover. Sally Ann was crumpled down in the seat, her head lolling from side to side with each jerk and sway of the vehicle, and Tungata was tall and heavy-shouldered beside her, his white shirt gleaming in the reflected glare of the headlights. Craig released his grip with one hand and made a grab for the back of the seat to pull himself on board. Instantly the Land Rover swerved violently, and in that same instant he saw the glint of Tungata's eyes in the rearview mirror. He had been watching Craig, waiting to catch him off balance and throw him. The centrifugal force rolled Craig over and out over the side of the vehicle. He had to hold with his left hand only, and the muscles and tendons crackled with the strain of his full weight. He gasped with the agony as it tore up his arm into his chest, but he held on, hanging overboard with the steel edge catching him in his injured ribs again. Tungata swerved a second time, running his wheels over the verge, and Craig saw the bank rushing up at him in the headlights. He was attempting to wipe him off the Land Rover on the bank, trying to shred him to pieces between shaly rock and sharp metal. Craig screamed involuntarily with the effort as he jackknifed his knees up and over. There was a rushing din of metal and stone as the Land Rover brushed the bank. Something struck his leg a blow that jarred him to the hip, and he heard the straps part as his leg was torn away. If it had been flesh and bone, he would have been fatally maimed. Instead, as the Land Rover swung back onto the road, he used the momentum to roll across the back seat and whip his free arm around Tungata's neck from behind. It was a stranglehold, and as he threw all his strength into it, he felt the give of Tungata's larynx in the crook of his elbow, and the loaded feel of the vertebra like the tension of a dry twig on the point of snapping. He wanted to kill him. He wanted to tear his head off his body. But he could not anchor himself to apply those last few ounces of pressure. Tungata lifted both hands off the wheel, tearing at Craig's wrist and elbow, making a glottal cawing sound, and the untended steering wheel spun wildly. The Land Rover charged off the road, plunged over the unprotected verge onto the steep rocky slope, and with a rending screech of metal, crashed end over end. Craig's grip was torn open, and he was flung clear. He hit hard earth, cartwheeled, and lay for a second, his ears humming, and his body crushed and helpless, until he rallied and pulled himself to his knees. The Land Rover lay on its back. The headlights still blazed, and 30 paces down the slope, full in their beam, lay Sally Ann. She looked like a little girl asleep. Her eyes closed and her mouth relaxed, the lips very red against her pallor, but from her hairline a thin, dark serpent of blood crawled down across her pale brow. He started to crawl towards her, when another figure rose out of the intervening darkness, a great, dark, wide-shouldered figure. Tungata was clearly stunned, staggering in a half-circle, clutching his injured throat. At the sight of him, Craig went berserk with grief and rage. He hurled himself at Tungata, and they came together chest to chest. Long ago, as friends, they had often wrestled, but Craig had forgotten the sheer bull strength of the man. His muscles were hard and resilient, and black as the cured rubber of a transcontinental truck tire. And one-legged, Craig was unbalanced. Dazed as he was, Tungata heaved him off his foot. As he went down, Craig kept his grip, and despite his own strength, Tungata could not break it. They went down together, and Craig used his stump, driving up with the hard rubbery pad at the end of it, using the swing of it, and Tungata's own falling weight to slog into Tungata's lower body. Tungata grunted, and the strength went out of him. Craig rolled out from under him, reared back onto his shoulders, and used all his body to launch himself forward again to hit with the stump. It sounded like an axe swung double-handed against a tree trunk, and it caught Tungata in the middle of his chest, right over the heart. Tungata dropped over backwards and lay still. Craig crawled to him and reached for his unprotected throat with both hands. He felt the ropes of muscle framing the sharp, hard lump of the thyroid cartilage, and he drove his thumbs deeply into it, and at the feel of ebbing life under his hands, his rage fell away. He found he could not kill him. He opened his hands and drew away, shaking and gasping. He left Tungata lying crumpled on the rocky earth and crawled to where Sally Ann lay. He picked her up and sat with her in his lap, cradling her head against his shoulder, desolated by the slack and lifeless feel of her body. With one hand he wiped away the trickle of blood before it reached her eyes. Above them on the road, The following truck pulled up with a metallic squeal of brakes, and armed men came swarming down the slope, baying like a pack of hounds at the kill. In his arms, like a child waking from sleep, Sally Ann stirred and mumbled softly. She was alive, still alive, and he whispered to her, "Oh, my darling, oh, my darling, I love you so." Four of Sally Ann's ribs were cracked. Her right ankle was badly sprained, and there was serious bruising and swelling on her neck from the blow she had received. However, the cut in her scalp was superficial, and the X-rays showed no damage to the skull. Nevertheless, she was held for observation in the private ward that Peter Fungabera had secured for her in the overcrowded public hospital. It was here that Abel Corry, the public prosecutor assigned to the Tungata Zabiwe case, visited her. Mr. Corry was a distinguished-looking shona who had been called to the London Bar and still affected the dress of Lincoln's Inn Fields, together with a penchant for learned, if irrelevant, Latin phrases. "I am visiting you to clarify in my own mind certain points in the statement you have made already to the police, for it would be highly improper of me to influence in any way the evidence that you will give," Corry explained. He showed Craig and Sally Ann the reports of spontaneous Matabele demonstrations for Tungata's release, which had been swiftly broken up by the police and units of the 3rd Brigade, and which the Shona editor of the Herald had relegated to the middle pages. "We must always bear in mind that this man is ipso jure accused of a criminal act, and he should not be allowed to become a tribal martyr. You see the dangers. The sooner we can have the entire business settled, mutatis mutandis, the better for everybody." Craig and Sally Ann were at first astonished, and then made uneasy at the dispatch with which Tungata Zabiwe was to be brought to trial. Despite the fact that the roles were filled for 7 months ahead, his case was given a date in the Supreme Court 10 days hence. "We cannot, nudis verbis, keep a man of this stature in jail for 7 months," the prosecutor explained, "and to grant him bail and allow him liberty to inflame his followers would be suicidal folly." Apart from the trial, there were other lesser matters to occupy both Craig and Sally Ann. Her Cessna was due for its 1,000-hour check and certificate of airworthiness. There were no facilities for this in Zimbabwe, and they had to arrange for a fellow pilot to fly the machine down to Johannesburg for her. "I'll feel like a bird with its wings clipped," she complained.
"I know the feeling," Craig grinned ruefully, and banged his crutch on the floor.
"Oh, I'm sorry, Craig."
"No, don't be. Somehow I no longer mind talking about my missing pin. Not with you, anyway."
"When will it be back?"
"Well, Oxford Morgan sent it out in the diplomatic bag, and Henry Pickering has promised to chase up the technicians at Hopkins Orthopaedic. I should have it back for the trial."
The trial. Everything seemed to come back to the trial, even the running of King's Lynn, and the final preparations for the opening of the lodges at Zambezi Waters, could not seduce Craig away from Sally Ann's bedside and the preparations for the trial. He was fortunate to have Hans Groenewald at King's Lynn, and Peter Younghusband, the young Kenyan manager and guide whom Sally Ann had chosen, had arrived to take over the daily running of Zambezi Waters. Though he spoke to these two every day on either telephone or radio, Craig stayed on in Harare, close to Sally Ann. His leg arrived back the day before Sally Ann's discharge from hospital. He pulled up his trouser cuff to show it to her. "Straightened, panel beaten, lubricated, and thoroughly reconditioned," he boasted.
"How's your head?"
"The same as your leg," she laughed, "although the doctors have warned me off bouncing on it again for at least the next few weeks." She was using a cane for her ankle, and her chest was still strapped when he carried her bag down to the Land Rover the following morning. "Ribs hurting?" He saw her wince as she climbed into the vehicle. "As long as nobody squeezes them, I'll pull through."
"No squeezing. Is that a rule?" he asked.
"Well, I guess..." She paused and regarded him for a moment before she lowered her eyes and murmured demurely, "But then, rules are for fools and for the guidance of wise men." And Craig was considerably heartened.
Number 2 Court of the Mashonaland Division of the Supreme Court of the Republic of Zimbabwe still retained all the trappings of British justice. The elevated bench with the coat of arms of Zimbabwe above the judge's seat dominated the courtroom. The tiers of oaken benches faced it, and the witness box and the dock were set on either side. The prosecutors, the assessors, and the attorneys charged with the defence wore long black robes, while the judge was splendid in scarlet. Only the colour of the faces had changed, their blackness accentuated by the tight snowy curls of their wigs and the starched white swallowtail collars. The courtroom was packed, and when the standing room at the back was filled, the ushers closed the doors, leaving the crowd overflowing into the passages beyond. The crowds were orderly and grave, almost all of them Matabele, who had made the long bus journey across the country from Matabeleland, many of them wearing the rosettes of the ZAPU party. Only when the accused was led into the dock was there a stir and murmur. And at the rear of the court, a black woman dressed in ZAPU colours cried hysterically, "Bayeti Nkosi Nkulu," and gave the clenched fist salute. The guards seized her immediately and hustled her out through the doors. Tungata Zabiwe stood in the dock and watched impassively, by his sheer presence belittling every other person in the room. Even the judge, Mr. Justice Domashawa, a tall emaciated Mashona with a delicately bridged atypical Egyptian nose and small, bright, bird-like eyes, although vested in all the authority of his scarlet robes, seemed ordinary in comparison. However, Mr. Justice Domashawa had a formidable reputation, and the prosecutor had rejoiced in his selection when he told Craig and Sally Ann of it. "Oh, he is indeed persona grata, and now it is very much in gremio legis. We will see justice done, never fear." While the country had still been Rhodesia, the British jury system had been abandoned. The judge would reach a verdict with the assistance of the two black-robed assessors who sat with him on the bench. Both these assessors were Shona. One was an expert on wildlife conservation, and the other a senior magistrate. The judge could call upon their expert advice if he so wished, but the final verdict would be his alone. Now he settled his robes around him, the way an ostrich shakes out its feathers as it settles on the nest, and he fixed Tongata Zabiwe with his bright dark eyes, while the clerk of the court read out the charge sheet in English. There were 8 main charges: dealing in and exporting the products of scheduled wild animals, abducting and holding a hostage, assault with a deadly weapon, assault with intent to do grievous bodily harm, attempted murder, violently resisting arrest, theft of a motor vehicle, and malicious damage to state property. There were also 12 lesser charges. "By God," Craig whispered to Sally Ann, "they're throwing the bricks from the walls at him." "And the tiles off the floor," she agreed. "Good for them. I'd love to see the bastard swing." "Sorry, my dear, none of them are capital charges." And yet all through the prosecution's opening address, Craig was overcome by a sense of almost Grecian tragedy, in which an heroic figure was surrounded and brought low by lesser, meaner men. Despite his feelings, Craig was aware that Abel Corey was doing a good businesslike job of laying out his case in his opening address, even displaying restraint in his use of Latin maxims. The first of a long list of prosecution witnesses was General Peter Fongabera. Resplendent in full dress, he took the oath and stood straight-backed and martial, with his swagger stick held loosely in one hand. His testimony was given without equivocation, so direct and impressive that the judge nodded his approval from time to time as he made his notes. The Central Committee of the ZAPU Party had briefed a London barrister for the defence, but even Mr. Joseph Pital, QC, could not shake General Fongabera, and very soon realised the futility of the effort, so he retired to wait for more vulnerable prey.